now.
Hi, this is Lisa Nichols, and you're listening to David Wood on the Kick-Ass Life Show.
Kick ass.
Whoa, that's kick ass.
Welcome to the Kick Ass Life.
Kick ass. Adventure. Want to make your life better? This is the Kick Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
So, hey everyone, here we are. We're in,
Where are we?
I'm in a room full of very attractive women and a couple of really hot guys and a really cute baby. And we just finished a 2.5 day event, and I suppose I should ask you all by a level of sound, how was your event? Yeah, the truth is I couldn't have paid them all. I may have paid them all, but I didn't. So, 2.5 days. I mean, you're a regular listener to the show. Why don't you introduce yourself? You're now on the show.
Oh, my goodness. Hello, I'm Chelsea from Toronto, and I'm just blown away and so inspired by this event that we had this last weekend here in Vegas.
And Chelsea, you're one of these people that listened to the show first, and you heard me saying if you're looking for a vehicle,
yeah,
and you're now here at this kind of event,
yeah,
and we don't have to talk about what vehicle it is, but are you glad? Are you glad you made the choice?
I'm so glad. I reached out on Facebook, and I couldn't be happier with what I've been connected with through David.
Looking forward to the future?
Yeah, it's life-changing for sure, for me and my family.
So let's just do we'll do a couple of words from each of you. So we'll go around, say your name, where you're from, a couple of words. Because actually today's show, I'm being interviewed by Sandra Yancey, because I knew I'd be on the road. She is the owner of eWomen Network, 500,000 entrepreneurial women. So this is a pre-recorded show. So this is just our beginning wrap. So let's go around and find out who's here. Say your name, where you're from, and how was your last couple of days?
I'm Jen.
The Jen
from Kelowna. And event was amazing. My one word would have to be family.
Aww. Mm. So, this is the guy. This guy's ripped. We're going to ask him to take his shirt off. He's so
okay, that's quite exciting. My name's Atif from Toronto. You can call me Coach AK otherwise. Experience has been just incredible. From party, not sleeping almost any of the nights, but yet I was there in the meetings, and I was there when I was meant to be. And what I got out of is some leads that are going to take me globally to the next level that I never expected.
So you're an entrepreneur who's found another vehicle and you're excited.
Yes, this is another tool that's going to take my business to the next level and helping lives.
As a guy that's always about absolute health, you train some of the top bodybuilders in the world, or what do you call them?
Fitness models and athletes.
When you saw those athletes on stage, did it blow your mind at some of the best?
Unfortunately, I missed that part.
Oh, so you
missed that part because I was actually about making connections.
Ah, awesome. No worries.
Yeah, so
one word is what? One word for you?
One word for me is belief.
Belief. All right. Belief. Here's another listener, regular listener.
Regular listener. I'm Barb from just north of Toronto.
Not just Barb. This is Jen.
Hi, Barb! This is Mama Bear.
She's nuts. Yeah.
Mama Bear. And
one word for the event?
Passion.
Look at
passion.
You. Everyone go. All right.
I don't know if I did that song. My name is Candice. I'm from Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. And my word for the day was inspiration. It was just amazing to see all those people doing their transformations for their life. There was so many wives.
That Ice of Body Challenge. See those?
Awesome.
Did you cry? I cried all the way through.
Awesome.
All right. Okay, who's next?
Pam from Elkford, British Columbia.
Elkford. Look at all these Canadians. What's your word?
My word is amazing.
Amazing. All right.
This is
the lady that works with her hands. She makes people feel better.
And my name's Christine from Craven, Saskatchewan, and I'm inspired.
Inspired?
Yeah.
You're all glowy. You've got a twinkle in your eye.
You are glowy.
Is that from the event or the wine?
Could be both.
All right.
Hi, I'm Michelle. I'm from Regina Beach, Saskatchewan, Canada. I would have one word. I would have to say it affected me spiritually.
Wow.
And my goal is I'm going to be on stage doing those flips
next year. Now, you're already an elite athlete.
I'm a fitness competitor.
When you saw those elite, like, gold medalists, elite athletes on stage talking, did that blow your mind?
It blew my mind, but I felt connected to them, and I just wanted to jump up and do that stuff.
You can flex right now.
Hug everybody.
Flex right now. Oh, look at those. I'm keeping my shirt on.
By the way, every one of these girls could curl us or bench us.
Exactly.
She can flex her butt like that, too.
All right. Okay, here's another regular listener. We met through the show as well.
Yes.
And you're here as well.
I'm here.
You're one of those people that said, tell me.
Who would have thought? So I'm Paula. I live in Edmonton, but I'm proud to say I'm a Newfoundlander. So
change that Newfoundland.
And my one word for today, as every day in my life now, is grateful.
Aww, gratitude.
And
thank you. You listen to all the shows.
I listen to every show, and I listen to some shows 3-4 times over. I just love it, and I just wish you would do one every day and not just 3 times
and
a week.
What we keep telling people out there is people who listen to the show, finally we're going to meet someday, we're going to become good friends like us, right?
Oh, absolutely, and I can't believe, like, 6 months ago I started listening to the show, and now twice I've been in your company, so...
Ooh! Twice I've been in your company.
Right,
let's keep this in perspective.
Yes,
all right, okay.
My name is Andrea, I'm from Kelowna, BC.
Woo!
The lovely Andrea Clipperton.
Yes, and my word would be powerful.
Powerful?
Yeah, it was a very powerful weekend.
Yeah, are you ready?
I'm ready.
You look ready. Like you're going to kick some ass.
Yes.
All right, moving right along here, another lady who works with her hands. And
I'm Charlotte Sebastian from Craven, Saskatchewan as well. And I have two words. One is home, because this is definitely my home. I'm so clear on that vision, completely in it, never going to quit. And leadership, because I really feel like I can and need to step up as a leader.
Awesome.
So I think that that's just been really big for me this weekend. It's been so many things, inspirational. I'm glad to have my girls here, more and more people all the time coming. And thanks to Gina for being such an awesome leader for us and getting us here from the beginning.
All right.
Definitely.
And...
Gina from Regina, Saskatchewan.
Yay. Gina, what's your thoughts?
My word is beautiful. It's so absolutely life-changing, inspiring to be in a room with such beautiful people inside and out. Spiritually,
awesome.
Physically, it's so inspiring.
Awesome. And then Michael's here, the producer of the show.
I'm Michael O'Neill from San Diego, California.
He's looking very GQ with his wine in his hand.
Nice.
He's looking very GQ right now.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I'm Michael O'Neill.
Great haircut. That's a great haircut.
By the way, are you making that?
No, I'm being serious.
First of all, for anybody just to paint a visual, whatever they're putting in the water in Canada is ridiculous. I just want you guys to know. I took a picture so I could put it in the show notes.
All right.
It's nuts. It's just nuts.
You're talking about how beautiful these women are.
Yes.
Now, I was just trying to interpret.
Yeah.
Whatever they're putting in the water, I don't know what's going on, but they've all got three eyes.
No, it's amazing. Exactly. Whatever they're doing is great. Family for me.
Family.
This was a wonderful reunion for me. So
awesome.
Family was really my word of the weekend.
Awesome. And so after spending the weekend on stage in front of thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people, now we're going to hand over to the wonderful Sandra Yancey, who's going to lead me through an interview where I know, because we pre-recorded it, she's going to get me to talk about some things I haven't talked about before ever. So here we go. Enjoy the show. We'll see you.
Hi, this is Sandra Yancey, CEO and founder of eWomen Network. And I know you're wondering if you're at the right place right now. And I just want you to know you are listening right now to the Kick-Ass Life podcast by David Wood. And we've flipped chairs here for just a minute, because you probably already know what I know, those of you that are his regular listeners from all across 171 countries. But David is a close personal friend of mine, colleague, and I would even say coach. This is a man that I've known for a number of years and have really just kind of cemented a really great friendship over the last 6 months. And as I've gotten to know David well, one of the things that became really clear to me, because I'm an avid listener of the Kick-Ass Life podcast, was that he's always interviewing and bringing out the knowledge and the wisdom and gifts of others. But I must say, David is just a star in and of himself, and someone that is so rich in thought and deep in feeling and contribution, just how he has impacted my life. That we were just chatting one day and I said, we've got to change this around. And I would love to have the opportunity to let your audience, the people that are already in love with you, and perhaps the ones that are just tuning in for the very first time today, to really know the real David and just who and what you're about and why you have launched this most successful The Kick-Ass Life podcast series. So it's my honor to be able to introduce to you, perhaps in a deeper level than you've ever known before, David Wood. Let me tell you a little bit about him. David Wood is the host of this, the Kick-Ass Life podcast. This show, just so that you know, it broadcasts in 171 countries and features some of the most respected authors, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders literally in the world. David is an author, a trainer, a life coach. He's a humanitarian and a business leader. And he's lived, traveled, and worked in over 50 countries. David has grown multiple multi-million dollar companies and is a strategic consultant to a $2 billion health and wellness company located in the United States. He brings his global experience and deep understanding of the human condition to create some of the most dynamic, engaging, fun, and effective trainings and courses on three continents. David is also a spokesperson, fundraiser, and advocate for the Make-A-Wish Foundation and helped raise millions of dollars as the international spokesperson for Child Help. David, welcome to your own show, The Kick-Ass Life.
Well, I had little tears welling up in my eyes there. I thought, who's that nice guy? I want to meet him.
You know, I'm going to start with that. What is it like? Because, you know, when you're being introduced on a main stage, right, there's all kinds of things going on around, and you often don't have the chance to really kind of quietly sit in and sit back and kind of listen to the introduction. But it's very different in this kind of format. What was it like for you to hear yourself described?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, you're right. I don't even use business cards, so I'm not a big title guy, and I suppose I don't take myself so seriously, as you know. I almost feel like this accidental success in some ways, but yeah, it's a fascinating thing to hear it, and then you think, oh yeah, that's what I do. And it's the reverence in your voice as well, because, you know, when you hear someone like yourself, who I have such deep regard and respect for, who does such great things, and you know, when you talk about being a coach, and, you know, it's kind of, yeah, it's very humbling.
Yeah. So who is the David Wood that isn't on the bio?
Well, you know, I think one thing that people say about me who know me well, my closest friends, and I mean, I have close friends who listen to the show that I hang out with a lot and who are business partners of mine. And I think a lot of people would say that the same guy exists on stage in front of 8,000 people as exists sitting here right now. The noise you can hear behind me is the lapping of waves on the beach. I'm just sitting in my little cottage here on the water. But I think that's the Dalai Lama actually gave me permission to show up authentically. So I think I'm the same guy. I do know that for many, many people in our field, there is very much one persona for the public and another persona for private, and I feel that that doesn't, I don't think there's any difference in any way at all, and I feel very lucky about that as well.
Absolutely, and that's been my experience of you too, which is actually quite refreshing, you know, no surprises, so to speak. You know, let's talk about your early years. I'm curious to know where you are now and you know, the Kick-Ass Life podcast and all of that. But I want to back up a little bit. Tell us a little bit about your early years. What was it like to be a young David Wood?
How far back are you going? You want me to go back like when I was a little tiny fella?
Well, you know what, when you were, you know, I mean, when you can kind of remember with some substance and start making meaning of what was going on around you.
Well, you know, the one thing I realize that I have in Oodles is empathy. And I think the empathy comes from a life that was quite, you know, in some ways, if I compare it to the third world, or I compare it to sort of, you know, the kids in Egypt living in the garbage, which I've seen and been around, you know, it was a pretty, I had a pretty lucky and amazing life. When I see, you know, I grew up in different countries. And so I lived in Cyprus when I was five. I started school in Cyprus, which is a little island off of Greece. And it has a Greek side and a Cypriot side. So I grew up with a lot of different cultural experiences. And then my dad was in the army, so we moved to Germany. And, you know, it was, but I never really fit in anywhere because I was constantly on the move. So, you know, when you're in the army, you're constantly moving from school to school, from community to community. And so it was very hard. So I became very much a bit of a loner. I wasn't overly confident. I wasn't very well liked. I didn't have a lot of friends at school, funny enough, because I, you know, it's something that I've developed over the years. But I, you know, I was very much a kid on my own with a couple of friends, but not, I was never the life of the party, or I was a bit of a joker though. I mean, the only way I got to survive through some of the stuff we went through as kids was my sense of humor. And my sense of humor was very disarming. When my mom and dad separated, and again, I don't normally talk about this a lot, so it's kind of fun. They separated when I was seven, and my mom was just mortified. It was her best friend. And my dad left us in Germany. So we were kind of in a foreign country, and my mom is absolutely mortified. And just angry and upset and hateful. And so here we are, these kids and this woman stuck in a foreign country with nothing. And so that was an interesting part. And then we moved over to England. And to get back into the English system, we were put into a condemned building. And this is something that really, I think, sculpted a lot of my success. And I didn't realize it at the time, but we lived in a place called Duncan House. And it was a condemned building. I mean, the kids were getting shot there. And my sister used to put perfume on a handkerchief to walk up the stairs because it was, the stench was unbelievable. I can still smell it today. In fact, you don't smell those kinds of smells. You taste them. It's a taste, not a smell. And we lived on the third floor. And I remember this blue flaking door. And when you walked in, it was like, you know, for a young kid, you don't realize what poverty is. But I think by Western standards of poverty, you know, we had no fridge. One of the rooms was, we had a padlock on it. My mom would let us in there because there was human feces wiped all over the walls. We had one bedroom and there was three beds, and it was always chewed up by, we had mice and rats in this place, and they would just chew through our stuff. So, you know, we had to design systems to hang clothing in the middle of the room where these things couldn't chew through them. But our bedding was always chewed up because they used to steal the bedding, it was like polyester they'd steal out of these things. But every third night, I'd have to sleep with my mom, and I hated that. You know, and I was always the stronger kid in my family. My sister had a very weak stomach, so, you know, there was cat excrement in the... And anyway, I could go on and on, but it was just different. But here's the thing that happened that changed my life in many ways. My school playground was right opposite. And when I looked up from the school playground, I could see my blue front door. And I remember telling one of the kids, and the school, the boys played on the playground floor, and the girls were on the fourth floor roof, and they were all fenced in. So the boys and girls always played in different playgrounds. And so I was just there with a bunch of boys. And I remember saying, oh, that's my, I can see my house from here. And I started getting beaten up every single day. I was known as a slum kid. And I didn't know what a slum kid was. I didn't know what poverty was. I mean, I didn't feel poor. I didn't feel, even though these conditions, they didn't bother me as much as they bothered my sister. And of course, my mom was devastated. But that was something that that whole poverty piece and being beaten up because you were poor in that kind of regard. And the shame that started with that, I didn't realize how deep that was till later on, you know, when I became quite angry later on. So that was kind of the early stuff, which was a lot of people don't expect that when they see me because I have such a positive spirit typically, right?
Right. And so then you start moving into kind of those teenage years. And what was that like for you, David?
Well, you know, I was 13. I lost my virginity when I was 13. I've said that before. But I started dating a lot of older women. I mean, I was 15. I dated a woman of 36. I mean, just imagine that. I was just this. And I belonged to a drama group. And that's how I escaped from my home. I mean, I hated my mom. I just hated her. And by the way, we have a great relationship today. My dad was gone. I didn't see my dad till I was 15. And so, you know, but I just hated her. And I learned, you know, what, I mean, the pain my mom was carrying, I didn't understand as a young kid. I just thought she was, you know, just out of lunch the whole time. But I left home. I left school at 15. I was terrible at school. I mean, I hated school. I used to get, you know, I wasn't a kid that fit in anywhere. And so I remember my history teacher sat me down, Mr. Austin. He said, David, he said, you're the worst student I've had in 37 years of teaching, and you're probably going to end up in jail or on the streets. And I got up and I gave him, I mean, being the enlightened 15-year-old that I was, I said, thank you so much for sharing, professor. And I told him to F off. And I left school that day. I left home shortly afterwards, and I started dabbling in business. But I'd been out of the home for many years. I mean, at 15, I'd already been out of the home pretty much most of the time since I was probably 12. You know, and I always found a reason to be out. And I had three jobs. I was always working. I used to buy my mom cigarettes because when she smoked, she was always kinder. So I used to make an effort of earning enough money so I could buy her smoke. So my mom was always broke. And so, you know, it was great. You know, and for me, I don't ever look back at any of that with any kind of anything but thank goodness, because I just really am. I'm so grateful that I got to lead that life, because I think, especially doing the work I do today, there's very few situations I can stand in front of that I haven't seen, felt, experienced, and in some degree, I mean, some are worse, but you know, they're all along the same kind of stuff, right? And because I know without question that, you know, we can design our life, we can reprogram ourselves, we can step into whatever we want, everything's available, that for me, that gives me permission to look someone in the eye and know it with certainty. And I think that's why a lot of people follow the work I do, right?
Yeah, well, you do have this aura around you, around just conviction of your beliefs. You know, there are those people that memorize, you know, mantras and can give great quotes, but you just embody, you really do have this energy and this aura around you that's coming clearly from your experiences. So fast forward a little bit for me. You're now out of your teens, right? And you're now an adult, past 21. And where are you and what are you doing and how has your past now shaped where you are at that time?
Well, it really hasn't yet. I was 20, and you know, by the way, we know that men don't grow up till they're 42. So I mean, I don't know if you could use the word adult and man and 20 all in the same sentence. So, you know, yeah, are you asking if I learned not to pee on the seat? Well, you know, but you know, I was potty trained by then. But you know, what happened was I was in I used to play in a dart team. And I was a heavy, heavy drinker. I was running a pub in the weekends. This was when I was 15. I started running a pub on weekends, but I worked in pubs a lot. I played a lot of darts, and I was playing high-level darts, like, you know, county level, like, or state level.
Wow.
And so, you know, so I was always in the pub smoking, drinking, you know. But what happened was I got into, all my friends were doing dope. All my friends were really, you know, just either getting drunk or getting high. And I met a girl who, again, was quite older than me, and she introduced me to meditation. And so here I am, this young punk, and I go and do this course on meditation with a guy called Maharaji, and I learned this technique. And it was a very powerful love affair that lasted just a few months. But it was like, you know, the sort of the waves parted and the sun shone. It was one of those. But here we are doing these deep meditative, you know, and tantric kind of connections between me and this woman. And what happened was I started writing poetry. And in the poetry, I started reading these. And I would write 2 or 3 poems a day. It was crazy. And, you know, here I am getting high and drinking. But I started to sort of read my own poems. And I remember, I mean, even now, I mean, I wrote this when I was 18 or 19. And, you know, it was kind of like, you know, to be alone in a crowded room, is there something wrong with me? How come the people around me don't see the things I see? It's easy to take another drink and obscure the life we've made and hide behind faded minds what stupid games we play, striving to accomplish, to make the coffers full, to build our little kingdoms that we try in vain to rule. And when we have our precious objects, it's then the trouble starts, because you can't take possessions with you when this world you do depart. And when the end of time has come, your life just slipped you by. Your mind was too preoccupied to ask quite simply why. Why is my body breathing? What am I doing here? Why not ask these simple questions? Or is it the answers that you fear? Fear because the material world and the power that we hold will simply have no meaning as our true life's quest unfolds. And I'm writing this stuff and I'm reading it. Who the hell?
Leave it. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. I mean, just take a pause for a minute, David. And you are how old when you write this?
18 or 19, probably.
This is the wisdom of a soul much older than a teenager, a 20-year-old. Amazing to me. And you know, I mean, you were rattling this off. You know, I mean, it's like it is tattooed on you. It's amazing to me, the insights of what you were in touch with at such an incredibly young age.
Well, it was a real thank you, by the way. It was a real paradox because, you know, on one hand, we're getting high, and everyone I knew carried an ounce of Moroccan black and a little tobacco tin and rolling papers, and, you know, they weren't like you think of people who are all getting high and young and long hair. I mean, some of these guys were business guys. It's just like everyone I knew was just getting high, right? And so I had this kind of duality going on where I was sort of still doing that, but then escaping to my book and writing every day. And then I think what it was is I started to notice within the writing that there was, you know, I felt cold in a way, right? And so, you know, and so then something happened that changed everything. Was at 20, 12 of my mates were going on a 6-day vacation to Tunisia. And I didn't even know what Tunisia was. I mean, I left school at 15. I could hardly read and write. And I got my highest exam result I ever got was 7%. And that was from my history teacher, the asshole, who said, I gave you that because you spelt your name right. I mean, I just wasn't functioning at school at all. You know, they put me in, what do they call it? Remedial, they called it back then. I had to go and sit in a class full of, you know, special needs kids. Yeah, I felt very special, I can tell you that. And, you know, and I was rebellious and I was, you know, but I still had my humor. I mean, my humor has always sort of kept me out of completely sort of jumping into the sort of the negative mix, I suppose. But what happened was I left on this 6-day trip and I'd been riding a lot and I bought a backpack to go with me, which was kind of strange. And it was the cheapest thing I could buy and it was the most uncomfortable thing I could buy. And when everyone left, I had about $2,000 left and I decided to travel until my money ran out. And I remember walking to the airport, and I was taking a taxi to the airport with this, you know, 11 other people. And as they flew away, I turned around, and for the first time in my whole life, I was terrified. I mean, I've been scared a lot. I mean, I think when you're angry, you're always in fear. But I was terrified because here I am in a strange country, and I'd been there with, you know, 11 people getting drunk every night and, you know, and completely oblivious to any culture, cocooned in a, you know, in an all-inclusive resort where it was all, you know, it was an Arab feel, but that was all it was. I didn't understand anything. And I was terrified. Yeah, go on.
Can I ask you a question? So what, I'm curious to know what was going on in you that said, I'm not going back. I'm not leaving with my friends. What was going on that made you make that decision to begin with?
I can't remember what the trigger was. I think that, you know, I had my own little business. I was a window cleaner. I was a chimney sweep. You know, I had all these businesses where I was kind of constantly working. And as I built my business, I started working with richer and richer people because they had more money, right? So I started window cleaning for these great big manor homes of lords and English gentlemen and all this kind of stuff. And I think I started to get a taste of and looking through the windows of, you know, people who were very wealthy. And I started on a council estate, you know, where, you know, you look through a window and you couldn't see the carpet because there was crap everywhere. And suddenly you're looking through, you know, the windows of gentry and people and seeing, you know, carvings from Africa and maps of the world and ivory and all this stuff. And I think that maybe subliminally I started to see that there was something bigger than my small little town and my small little mind, right? So...
Okay, so now your friends are gone, you're terrified, you have $2,000. What do you do?
I go back to the hotel room and I spend a whole week there terrified because I didn't want to leave. I was afraid to go out. So I almost blew $1,000. It was $840, I think, I spent my first week because I wouldn't go outside. And I kept looking at my passport thinking, when I go home, I'm going to show everyone where I've been. And I had this one stamp for Tunisia in my passport. And you know, finally I thought I gotta get another stamp. It was nothing to do with me at this point. It was all about, I was a prover for so many years. Everything that came out of my mouth was, you know, a prover. You know, I wanted everyone to know how smart I was. I wanted to know people and what I'd done. I used to lie about stuff just to make things sound better. And so, you know, as this kind of born again, well, as this prover, I was really thinking I just need to get some more stamps. So when I go back, people will say, well, that was awesome, right? And so I remember walking into a travel agent in Tunisia and trying to buy a ticket to Israel because I had heard Israel was a place travelers could travel. I had no idea about the Israeli conflict. I had no idea about the Arab-Israeli conflict. And this guy in the travel agent saying, well, you can't buy a ticket to Israel because it doesn't exist. And I'm saying, well, of course it exists. Look on the map. And he said, well, no, that's Palestine. That's not Israel. I said, what do you mean Palestine? What the hell's Palestine? You know? And so here I am, this ignorant little, you know, waif who's out there. And finally, I flew to Egypt. And I met a guy called Paul Orchid in Egypt, who's this Aussie guy. And another guy called Bruce from America, and I started moving around with some different people, and I started watching them, and it gave me more confidence to step outside at least and start looking and noticing. And then it took about a year and a half before the fear stopped, and I was living in Israel at the time, and I don't remember the day, but I just remember not being afraid anymore. And then I started to see the world. I mean, before that, I was just in it. And I was in it for a lot of reasons, but I don't think they were good reasons. They were just reasons for, you know, to prove that I could travel around the world or anything. But then I started to really notice and see things, and I started to step into situations where and of course that muscle built. It wasn't immediate, but I noticed, you know, everything changed. The colors changed. I changed, right?
And so now tell me what was the pivotal thing that happened in your life that made this huge shift in you that really launched you, you know, into a career and a business in really transforming people's lives?
Well, that's a big step forward. You know, I mean, I backpacked for 10 and a half years, 42 countries. When I arrived in Canada, I slept on a roof the first night. I always slept on a roof everywhere, every country I'd go to, because I worked illegally all over the world. So I would sleep on a roof because, I mean, A, it's really safe up there. No one wanders about on rooftops, I can tell you that. So I would always find a roof to sleep on, and I'd sleep peacefully that first night. And then the next day when I would find a job and somewhere to live. And so I arrived in Canada, slept on a roof the first night. My first job was cleaning rooms at the Abram Hotel, which the owners are still there, the same owners, Gene and Alan, still own the Abram Hotel. Because this was in
How long ago was this?
1989.
Okay. Okay.
Right. And I was illegal in Canada. So, you know, as far as working and then I worked in a fish and chip shop called Barb's Fish and Chips. And, you know, what happened was, you know, I worked everything I learned about true success was the reason why people would employ me illegally was because I would offer to work for free. So I say, look, I'll work for free. Just give me someone to sleep. And then I'd work my ass off. I would work in a way and I'd bring such a positive spirit to whatever I did that they would get addicted to having, even when I cleaned rooms, I did the best job, I would work the fastest, I would do more, I would give more to my employers. And then what would happen was, after 3 or 4 days, I said, oh, I'm sorry, I got to get out of here. And they say, why is that? I said, well, I need to make some money. And they said, oh, no, we'll pay you. So that's how I got under the
how strategic. Yeah. You have a certain element of real street smarts. Like, you know, who else thinks about needing a place to sleep and says, I know, I'll just go on the roof? I mean, who thinks like that, David?
Well, I know.
Except you.
Well, and again, what happened was, when I was working in the fish and chip shop, this guy was there, and his fishing boat had sunk at the wharf. He was a commercial diver, and it was an old boat built in 1936 or 1942 or something. It was a really little old fishing boat. And we became friends, and he said to me, you know, if you can get a permit, I'll take you out and you can dive with me. So I took the girl out from the fisheries department for dinner, and I managed to snoogle my way into a permit. And I went out and I worked on this fishing boat and watched the west coast of Vancouver Island, you know, with the orcas and the seals and the sea lions and the wildlife and the bald eagles and the fish and everything, dolphins and it was like unbelievably beautiful. And then underwater in the kelp beds, you know, but in the wheelhouse was a picture of Banff and Lake Louise. And I made a desire. I said, before I leave Canada, I'm going to get there. And it took me a year and a half to get there and loads of adventures. And by which time I'd fallen in love with Canada and I decided to make it my home. So.
Okay, so, but now you're in this whole transformational personal development.
Well, I haven't got there. I'm sorry. You asked me that question. I didn't ask that.
Yeah.
Okay. What happened was this. So I end up getting married. I start companies. I do quite well. I had a restaurant and bar. I've done all kinds of companies. I mean, a natural products distribution company. I moved around different kind of areas. I had an equipment company. Anyway, so When I decided at one point, I was running a restaurant, or I owned a restaurant, a country and western saloon, believe it or not. And we called it fun dining. And I decided to sell that, and I wanted to buy a home. I'd seen a home in the Kootenays on one of my days off, and I thought, and I gave the guy, I think I'd give him $200 and a piece of cardboard that said, I'm going to buy your house, non-refundable deposit. And I hand this guy $200, and it's this gorgeous house overlooking a glacier. And I needed some money to buy this house, so like $270,000. It wasn't like I needed, because all I had was $200, right? And so I phoned a friend of mine. I said, listen, send me somewhere in the world where I can make a lot of money fast. So she ended up sending me to South Africa. And I worked down in South Africa. And at the Christmas time, everything closes down for about 6 weeks. So I ended up going on this journey. A woman I didn't know very well lent me a car for 3 months, and I drove a car on my own with a tent and a little, you know, all the things you need for camping. And I drove all the way through South Africa, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Botswana, and all the way back, right? And on my trip into Zimbabwe, I missed a ferry, and I met a woman there with her boyfriend, and I traveled for 3 days with her, who later became my wife. And so she's Swedish, and we met in Africa on this. I mean, we you know, bungee jumped off Victoria Falls, and we did the white water rafting down the Zambezi, which is the biggest in the world. So we've got these like major bucket list items we've done together. She's got a boyfriend. I really liked him. There's nothing going on between us. And then I invite her I phoned him about 6 months later to talk to both of them, and she'd separated. And so I said, what are you doing? She said, well, I was just going to go to Australia. I said, why don't you come to the Caribbean? I'll teach you how to sail and scuba dive. So she flies over. We spend 3 weeks on a sailboat in the Caribbean. Still nothing happens. But I fall in love with her. You know, I fall in love with this adventurous woman. And, you know, so we scuba dive together. We sail all over the Caribbean. And then I say, why don't you come to Canada? And we end up getting married almost right away. And we have a son. We get pregnant first try, you know. But we just didn't know each other. We weren't great friends. And so our marriage wasn't great. And who I was at the time, I was still carrying all this stuff. I was still angry inside. I wasn't able to commit 100%. I wasn't able to jump in with both feet. I still was protecting everything in my heart, right? And our marriage was failing after a number of years. My son was about 5 or 6. And she said to me one day, she said, hey, listen, she said, there's a personal development program I've heard about. Do you want to go to it? And I'd never done any personal growth. I said, sure. Because, I mean, I said yes to everything. I said, sure. So we go to a T. Harv Eker warrior camp, which is like fire walks and, you know, ropes courses and all this kind of really outward bound stuff. And halfway through the second day, I looked at Harv on stage doing what he did. And I knew in that moment that was my calling. And I looked at my wife at the time. I said, I'm going to teach this program. And it was like this, you know, whoa. It was one of those moments, right? And you have to understand, 3 years before, I'd emceed a wedding that had gone horrifically wrong, where the whole groom side of the family had got up and left. They didn't speak to him for a year. I completely messed up the whole wedding. So I'd gone through 3 years of absolute humiliation and torture about being on stage. And I knew for one thing for sure was I would never, ever try to go on stage again. I wasn't ever working on stage. I just emceed this wedding. So watching Harv masterfully do what he did, I wanted to learn that. And that's what started it.
Amazing. And so you did that for a while, and then you decided to make another shift. And and of course, that's, I mean, that whole T. Harv Eker, you know, peak potential, all of that is pretty powerful stuff. So as you teach it, as you learn it, right, you're processing your own self and your own life.
Well, I think it was beyond that as well. I mean, he said to me at the end of the event, I went to Harvard and I said, hey, I want to teach this program. And he's a marketer, man. He's like, yeah, whatever. He said, well, once you do all my programs, you can ask me that question again. I said, all right. So I took a year off and I took 13 personal growth programs in 1 year. And, you know, within that process, he writes amazing programs. And him and I, we were pretty close at that time. But he could see that I was edgy. And I threatened a little bit of, because Harv is Harv. He's like a Tony Robbins right. character that, you know, he's central in his business. And, Tony Robbins doesn't want another Tony Robbins. You know, he doesn't mind guys working for him, but he still wants to be Tony Robbins. And Harv was a bit like that. And here I come along, completely irreverent, breaking all the rules, doing everything I want. You know, I mean, I still have this kind of like very, very different energy. And he sat me down one day. He says, Dave, I'm going to tell you something. You're never, ever going to work on one of my stages. I want you to get that into your head. And I looked at him. I don't know where it came from, Sandra, but this ballsy answer came out. I said, Harv, you can't stop me. I said, one day you're going to get really sick, and I'm just going to be ready. And 3 months later, you know, and I worked like a servant for Harv for a year. I volunteered at every event. And I was actually his assistant at one point. And what I did is I'd watch whatever anyone did, I would just do it better. So all the assistants, they would do something. I would do that something as well as they would do it. And then I add about five other things to it. And so he started to notice that there were these small changes that occurred every time I worked with him. And he liked that, right? So he liked me working for him as long as I was there, but he just told me I'd never be on stage. And so I just kept practicing, and I even practiced at my friend's clinic, and I videotaped it, and it's so hilarious. I mean, you talk about over the top. I mean, I scared the crap out of everyone in the room. I was trying to do all this accelerated learning. Good or good, yeah, come on. Rah, rah, rah. You know, I was just like this absolute bear. And what ended up happening was Harv got sick, and they had an event in
New Jersey. He actually got sick?
He got sick. He had an event, 1,600 people in New Jersey. And he needed someone. I went out there, and my sales were virtually identical to his on my first event. And even though I set fire to my jacket on the stage, and it blew all the lights in the arena. So anyway, so that was it. You know, I once I got in that door, you know, and Harv could see I could make him money, and you know, he likes money, and he's a great man, but I mean, he likes to make money. And I became his master trainer and could choose whatever program I wanted. And, you know, and I was sometimes selling between $1.5 and $4 million a weekend in personal growth.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And then, true to David Wood, you decided to make a shift yet again.
Well, what happened was, you know, I there was two reasons, really. And I mean, again, I want to sort of reiterate, Harv is a great man. I mean, our energy was always a bit clashy. You know, he wanted someone that would do what they were told, and I'm not a guy that will ever do what I'm told. I mean, I hate being told what to do. And Harv or anyone else, I'm not going to do what I'm told. I'm going to do what I feel is right. and, you know, and I'll live by the consequences of it, you know. So, you know, I mean, I used to help write stuff for Harv, and I used to write his offerings and all these different things, but still, you know, I was never going to be anything but second or third. So that was a little bit, not that that bothered me too much, but the part that bothered me was I started noticing my students would come back after a year or 2 years, and they would have invested like $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000 or even $30,000 in personal growth. And I realized that they just weren't getting ahead to the extent I thought they should. And what I realized, there was two things they were lacking. One was a vehicle. Because most would, they'd come to the Millionaire Mind Intensive, and we would sort of rewire their blueprint, and they'd go back into toxic worlds with toxic relationships, with toxic friends. And that's what I did. I divorced myself of all the toxicity. You know, I dealt with all, I just got away from any negative people, and I started surrounding myself by with powerful people. You know, and there's that great saying, you know, you become the sum of the five people you spend the most time with. And I realized these people were going back to toxic arenas. And then, you know, the other part was, so they lacked the vehicle, and they lacked a community of positive people, like I just said. So, you know, you combine those two things. Yep. I'm saying, you know what, I'm just not, I don't think that what I'm selling, I'm giving what I'm selling. And then I met Kathy Coover from Isagenics, and, you know, I could see they had the vehicle, they had the culture and the community that I could help form, and I could bring personal development within a culture, within a vehicle, and then I started to see real results. So that's what changed everything.
So knowing what you now know, David, what is it that you would most like to convey to your sons, to people that are, you know, tuning in and listening to you and are your loyal followers, are spreading the word about what you're doing? What is it that you would like to convey today to people most?
I think a couple of things. I think that, you know, it took me a long time to realize that I am not my circumstances. I am not my history. You know, I can choose any life I want. No one ever told me that. No one ever told me I could be wealthy. No one ever told me I could become a multimillionaire. No one ever sat down and said, Dave, you have what you want. You know, I had to learn that. It took me 42 years to learn how to stop lying. You know, I lied my whole life because I just wandered around with my mask on, so afraid of being authentic in myself and stepping into who I really was without the permission of other people. And what I realized was everyone's walking around with their own mask on, and no one was very, very happy. So just this idea that I could choose anything I wanted and that I could reprogram myself in a powerful, positive way to be able to contribute at a level so that when I wake up in the morning, when I go to bed at night, I feel full. And that's a feeling that I think we all deserve. I think everyone wants to know they've contributed, that they made a difference, that there's a reason. It doesn't have to be on a big scale like you do, Sandra, or maybe on a smaller scale like I do, but seriously, your company's massive. It's amazing. But on a scale where, you know, you make a difference, you know, in one person's life, you know, that you wake up happy and you go to bed happy and fulfilled, that you notice the beauty around you in the small things, that you're grateful for all the things in your life, both the positive and the negative. You know, you take taking responsibility for everything in your life and everything not in your life. So again, just stepping into a life of choice and creation, knowing that we are the ultimate creators and that whatever we can think about, we can bring about. I'm absolutely convinced that every person, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of background, regardless of education level, regardless of circumstance. I mean, look at Oprah. Oprah was raped when she was 9. You know, she was pregnant when she was 13. All right. And she left home when she was 13, pregnant when she was 15. Look, she goes on to become one of the great voices in the world of transformation and change. You know, one of the most, you know, powerful media people in the world. Now, she could have very easily been victim to those occurrences, you know, and the sexual and physical abuse and all the other things she went through. Yeah, but she wasn't. Her story did not define the outcome in her life. It contributed to her having a voice. It contributed to her being so empathetic. And that's why I think her show is so amazing, because when she sits with people, The judgment isn't there. There's not this canned response. There's a deep knowing in her heart of those kinds of pains because she lived them. And because she lived them and she doesn't sit in them, she is this ultimate position to be able to help people move through them so beautifully and effectively, right? Boom. They just pass through those things with her as a light. And I think we all have that possibility. And I think that the trap for most people is they become victim to the circumstances. They believe it's true and they start living a very small life. And I think that, you know, my words would be is to, first of all, change your environment. If you're not going to bed happy, you're not waking up happy, number one thing is to change your environment. Number two is to change your thoughts. And when we master our own thinking, and I show people this. In fact, Sandra, when I come to your event, I'm going to demonstrate this on stage. I just decided in this moment, you know, how even a negative thought in our head can diminish our power. And you can physically witness people's power being diminished. And yet what most people are, and I was for years, is one negative thought right behind the other is like what constant stream of negativity. And so we have to become masters of our own thinking. And if we just were focused on those two things, you know, making sure that our environment, that we surround ourselves with people that, you know, when we leave them, we feel bigger than we are when we arrive. And consequently, we have to be that person. When we're around people, people should feel like they've had a hot soapy bath after they've spoken to you. They shouldn't feel like they've just been stuck in a swamp, right? And they just want to go and have a bath. And so we can control that by just showing up in our bodies, showing up authentically, noticing people, being fascinated and curious by people, really listening. Now, even, you know, those people that you only pass, I'll give you an example of that. There was a woman I met yesterday, Brooke. We played a game of golf yesterday. It was yesterday. And the waitress walked out of the restaurant into the patio, and we'd just been on the course for 18. It was incredibly hot, 37 degrees. It was really, really hot. And so I was burnt a little bit. I could tell by her demeanor and by her stature that there was something going on with her. I could just feel it. And I looked at her, and I hadn't met her before. And my opening line was, "Hey, Brooke." I could see her name tag. She says, "Hey." I said, "Do you need a hug?" She said, "Oh, yeah." So I got up, and we had two guests there, family members who don't know me very well. They're Jen's family. And I wandered over, and I just held her for a second. I could feel her body just go, "Ah." And you could see she walked away with this big smile on her face. And when she came back out the doors a second time, and I could tell it was a work issue. That was something going on at work that was bothering her, right? And in that moment of just being there in your body, being present, being available, what a shift can happen from what, one little hug? But it's being seen, right? So we have that power. Everyone has the power. Everyone has the power to change the world, but it's not the world. It's the world that we witness every day. It's the world that we live in. It's the streets we walk down. It's the churches or the synagogues or the temples that we go to. It's the neighbor's house. That's the world that we can completely transform just by having the courage to show up.
And is that what the Kick-Ass Life podcast is about for you?
Yeah, I think it's about, you know, it started out really for me, you know, I was trying to find something that expressed how I feel about life. And yeah, it's kick-ass. It's a little irreverent, but it sort of conjures up, you know, a juicy life, squeezing the juice out of life. But I think that what I see from the reviews, if you go onto iTunes and read the reviews from the podcast, I mean, we've had everything from people who are on the verge of suicide, who have transformed and decided they want to live and they want to step into a greater life. We've had young kids of 13 who have left reviews of who have divorced themselves from their negative friends. You know, we've had couples that have wanted to instead of, you know, being roommates in their home, they wanted to step into and be deeply intimate and discover and bathe in each other's beauty. We've had everything from, you know, it's just giving people permission because, you know, my life wouldn't have changed if I hadn't have met one person. And if I hadn't have read one book, I mean, the Think and Grow Rich was the book that changed everything for me. And no one ever told me that stuff. And so I know that it only can take one encounter to give people permission to search out and sort of desire and step into something greater. So the kick-ass life to me is a very real, raw. I mean, it's not scripted. I don't sit there for hours. I mean, this morning I dragged my sorry ass out of bed, walked out onto the dock, pushed record. I had no idea when I pushed record what was going to come out of my mouth for my show this morning. And I loved the show. It was a beautiful show. For me, that was that's the essence of it. It's kind of a moment by moment thing, the evolution of, but it's always around the same thing. It's around, you know, stepping into a life of choice and having the willingness to or the courage to really, really, really be transparent, to truly be authentic, to be truthful. I mean, one of my favorite sayings, my 8 most powerful words, tell the truth all the time with compassion. Tell the truth all the time with compassion. You know, and I think that when we step into a life of absolute truth with compassion, when we step into complete authenticity, where we stand in ourselves with all of our shit and all of our crap and all of the other stuff that we may be embarrassed about, and we own it, and we own it with a little a little smile on our eyes, and we look back at it and say, thank goodness that happened. But then we start asking the questions about, you know, what is that one thing I can do with my life that would make a difference? Because I know that in that last breath of air, Sandra, when I take that last gasp, I want it to sound like this. What a rush. What a rush, right? Right? I don't want it to be, oh God, if only. And I think the show, what I've seen is it's giving permission for people to put down their armor and to open up their hearts and step into the unknown with a little twinkle in their eye, a spring in their step, and to say, I was almost going to swear there, but, you know, think of the F you, you know, to all of those negative thoughts and traits that typically we've learned through generations being handed down to us. And that's all I knew. I mean, I was just taught how to think, and I had to learn how to not think that way, right?
So for the people that are listening today, David, and they're struggling, and they're hearing you, and they want it, and they can taste what it must be like, right, to be out of whatever space they're in today. What's one thing they can do once we're done here, and they hang up, and they're like, you know, I got to do this. I got to do something. I've got to create my own kick-ass life. What's the one thing, David, you would tell them to do?
That's a great question. You know, everyone's slightly different where you're at and where you're at in your journey. So, I mean, there's a number of things that come to mind. I mean, as opposed to one thing, but the one thing, of course, is to look in the mirror. And really ask yourself a question. Are you happy? Because I think, you know, the Dalai Lama and other great people talk about, what's your quest? Well, why are we here? What's that question? I mean, and happiness is a birthright. And happy people live a long time. And I think that just bite off a small piece of the apple at a time. This is not something, you don't have to fix everything, but we have to fall in love with our own imperfection. We have to fall in love with that perfectly imperfect self. And self-love is something we can't give to the world anything that we don't have inside. We can't contribute to anything unless we've contributed to ourselves first. So it's a personal journey. And so I think to look into that question and ask just one area, choose one area of your life right now where you maybe not, it's the obvious one. Maybe you're in a crappy relationship, or maybe you're, you know, you hate your job. Maybe you're, you know, whatever it is. But if you could just choose one area first, don't take on the whole enchilada. Don't try and change everything overnight. Just take one area and take a step. Ready, fire, aim. Ready, fire, aim. You know, ready, you know it's in that area. Fire, do something about it. And then make the adjustments as you go, right? But you've got to realize it's not a thing you can do completely alone. You can't fight this battle alone. And it's just finding and linking arms with like-minded people who want to lead kick-ass lives, you know. And when you've got people around you, and Sandra, I know that, you know, you have a posse, and I'm probably part of that posse, someone you can call on when you just need a chat, someone you can tell, you and I just told each other a joke right before the before the show, you know, so someone that you can trust to to just, you know, have a walk with in this journey, and not, don't try and get it right. You know, getting it right is not the answer. It's really not the answer at all, you know. And perfection is not the goal. I think that what joins us together as a human race is our imperfection. It's what really connects us is the mistakes we've made. It's the cock-ups and the screw-ups and the mess-ups and the whatever. Those are the things that join us at the hip. Those are the things that we've all done. And quite often, we're so embarrassed about, it becomes the separator. It becomes the division between us and other people because we feel so badly about it. So just choose one area. Ready, fire, aim, and fire. Just step into it and say, I'm going to make a choice today that's going to move me closer to that happiness. So what are you going to do in this moment to take one step that will move you closer to that last breath of air where you're going to go, what a rush. What a rush. Yee-haw! That's why I lose my voice.
Okay, we're going to start to wrap up here. So I've got a couple of quick, what I like to call sentence stems, all right? So I'm going to start it out, and you're just going to go whatever, you know, whatever kind of rolls off your tongue and you're resonating with, and complete these, okay, so that our audience gets a little bit sense of, you know, where David Wood is today. Most people would be surprised to know that I...
I had like 100 things go through my head right now. there were so many rude ones as well. I don't even know if I could go there. That I lied for 42 years of my life.
The one thing I wish someone had told me earlier is...
That I could have whatever I wanted, and that it was there available to me right now. It's right there. It's like I'm already in, I'm in the soup where it all exists, and all I had to do was just reach out and get it. So no one ever told me I could have it all. No one ever said, Dave, you can have it all. And I believed that I couldn't, and I lived that life of I couldn't, and I don't deserve it, and I wasn't good enough or big enough or strong enough or wise enough or rich enough or smart enough, and none of that mattered. So no one told me I could have it all.
Okay, the one thing that I know about me that has never failed me is...
The courage to step into the unknown. I say two things, and the courage to tell the absolute truth.
Okay. When I want to give myself a reward, I
make a martini, a cold one. I throw a party. I bring my friends together. And I have all my friends hang out and just, and I bring a band in. I like to do that and just share it with all my friends.
Okay. And so when you have a really tough day, or I guess I should say, when I have a really tough day,
I look down and I compare down. I look at the women in Iran right now who are, you know, forced to be circumcised or wear burqas, or, and I, so excuse me if I use a country, but in certain countries in the world, I shouldn't use one country. I apologize, Iran. But I look at the kids in Africa, and I look at the kids in Egypt, and I look at people around the world that are kids who were put, you know, made to carry guns in Guatemala when they were 11, and I look at people who are terrorized and victimized around the world in every second, and people whose families were devastated in the Holocaust. And I think, what the heck have I got the, you know, what have I got? I am so freaking lucky. And I start to focus on gratitudes.
There you go. Bottom line, if you are really serious about wanting a kick-ass life, you must...
You must choose it. You've got to choose it, and you've got to. You can't listen to your thoughts. So our thinking is not designed to make us happy. our the brain is designed to keep us stuck and keep us in our comfort zone. So we can create a kick-ass life with our minds. We can't listen to the old condition. We have to reprogram ourselves to that. So we have these super highways that have created for over our whole lives in our brain. And for many people, it's a negative highway or not the most positive highway. So we have to not believe our thinking. If we have a negative thought come in our head, anyone, we have to disbelieve it. And we have to reprogram ourselves to really fall in love with who we are in this moment with all our crap, all our imperfection. So we can't believe our thinking. We have to recreate thinking that will empower us to live a kick-ass life.
Incredible. So if you're listeners right now, get only one thing from everything that we've discussed today, you would say what?
That you deserve it. You know, you deserve to have a kick-ass life, and it's okay. It's okay to go get it. You know, and it's not a sprint. It's a marathon. It's an ultra marathon. And if we just focus each day, if we wake up every morning and focus on gratitudes, if the last thing you do at night is focus on gratitudes, if every meal you focus on gratitudes, and if you can find someone to help every single day, I mean, stop your car. If you're driving along and you see someone on the side of the road who's taking a photograph of their kids, jump out and see if they want a group photo. You know, find a million little things you can do every day to make people's lives better and just go do it. Open that door. Hold the door longer. Give of yourself. Become a servant in this world, a servant of noticing and doing small, special things all the time. And that one act will fill your heart so full, and you won't notice it because you're not looking for the pat on the back. You're not looking for the reward. You're not looking for someone to say thank you. You're just in the habit of being present and noticing and doing beautiful things in every moment, as opposed to so busy with life that you forget to do them.
There you go. Okay, David, so I'm gonna ask you the question that you asked me when you interviewed me when we ended. And you said, and I'm gonna say to you, Sandra, you said to me, Sandra, what does a kick-ass life really mean to you? So I'm going to ask you the same thing, David. What does a kick-ass life really mean to you?
Kick-ass life to me is where I am completely transparent, which means you can look through. There's nothing hidden in any closet or cupboard in my heart or in my psyche. There's nothing I can't share with you. There's no story that I won't share openly. So I'm completely transparent. But a kick-ass life is where every word that comes out of my mouth comes out as if the person I was talking about was listening, and that it's only born in truth. So I'm transparent, I'm truthful. And a kick-ass life to me is where I step into a place of complete authenticity, where in every moment I'm completely me. It doesn't matter who I'm in front of, or whether I'm in front of presidents or I'm in front of paupers, you know, that the same person exists in every second. This authentic, wacky, weird, whatever I am, it doesn't matter. You have to be wacky and weird like me, but you have that authentic piece. So truth, transparency, authenticity, and love. To really practice unconditional love and to love the bad parts of people, not just the good, is to forgive. Oh, that's the other one, is to practice immediate forgiveness. Is whatever anyone does to you at any time, everyone's trying to do the best they can with what they've got. And as someone who stole most of my life, who lied most of my life, who cheated, I mean, I did a lot of things in my life that it's not that I'm not even proud of it, I just did them. And, you know, people are doing the best they can. So if people make a mistake and do something, just practice forgiving them. Because there's a great saying that says, when we hold on to anger, when we hold on to judgment, when we hold on to hatred, it's like drinking poison and expecting them to die, right? And so immediate forgiveness. And then unconditional love I think the quest of every person on the earth is to love ourselves unconditionally in all our imperfection, and to love others unconditionally, and let them see it. Let them see by the twinkle in your eye that you notice them.
Incredible. Well, David, let me just say that, you know, as we come to a close here, you know, just my own personal message. I'd be remiss if I ended and just didn't acknowledge you for, you know, the amazing man and friend that you are, and the greatness that I see in you. And I just feel so blessed that, you know, you think of the billions of people on the planet and, you know, I got to meet you, you know, and through knowing you, I've just grown to really, you know, appreciate you and love you. And I'm just so grateful to be able to say that you're my friend. And it's just an honor to do my part, my little teeny tiny part in the world to let everyone know that you exist, because you're really special, and you are changing lives, and you walk your talk, and you are, you know, real and tender and tough and just a sheer treasure. It's been an honor to spend this hour with you, and I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure everybody I know knows who you are. There's just everybody just deserves to have a little piece of David Wood and the kick-ass life.
Thank you.
That was kick-ass.